You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 11th of May 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, hundreds of people are injured after clashes between Palestinians and Israeli police in Jerusalem. We'll have the latest on the worst violence seen in the city for years. Also coming up, we crunch the numbers as China releases the results of its census and examine the influence a national headcount will have on the government's policies. We'll also find out what was said when the US president joined a meeting of NATO's Eastern European members, and we look at the effect of faith on people's health when it comes to taking the COVID vaccine.
The government and public health authorities worked with Buddhist monks there to identify, quote unquote, auspicious period to begin the vaccination campaign.
That's all coming up, plus the newspapers and the travel headlines too, on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Three journalists and two activists who fled from Myanmar to Thailand have been put on trial for illegally entering the country. If convicted, they're likely to be sent back to Myanmar, where they say they'll be killed. The US network NBC has said it will not show the Golden Globes because of a lack of diversity, and the US has authorised the use of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on all these. But first, let's get the latest on the violence, which has escalated in Jerusalem in the past 24 hours. The Palestinian Health Authority is claiming more than 20 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes against militant targets in the Gaza Strip. It's in response to rockets being fired at Jerusalem by Hamas, just minutes after the end of a deadline the Palestinian militant group had imposed on Israel to withdraw security forces from key parts of the city. Well, the past few days have seen the most serious confrontations for years, so let's get the latest now from Yossi Meckelberg, Senior Consulting Research Fellow at the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Atef Alsheir, who's the Lecturer in Arabic and Cultural Studies at the University of Westminster here in London. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Yossi, let's begin with you. I mean, just tell us what's happened in the last 24 hours. There has been a serious escalation of violence, hasn't there?
Yeah, this was a terrible escalation in violence, and you have the entire conflict, almost 130, 140 years of concentrated now in almost all fronts between the Israelis and Palestinians, between Gaza and Israel, Hamas and Israel in Jerusalem, in Al-Aqsa Mosque in the middle of the Ramadan, and inside Israel, between Arab Israelis, Palestinians that are citizens of Israel, and Jews. And the level of violence is almost unprecedented. There were 200 rockets fired from Gaza inside Israel. Israel attack, airstrike that what we know now killed at least 24 Palestinians, including 9 children. So this is one of the worst escalations I can remember for quite some time.
Atef, take us through the cause of the latest tensions, if you would. There are several factors which have led up to a huge build-up of tension, haven't there?
Definitely. I mean, the cause, there is obviously the historical cause, the fact that Israel has been occupying Palestine and the Palestinians for a very long time. And there has been accumulation of abuses and humiliations directed against the Palestinians. And the recent attacks by settlers, particularly taking things in their own hands in the West Bank, and particularly in East Jerusalem, have triggered this violence, particularly around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And during the month of Ramadan, as worshippers were attacked many times by Israelis, many by Israeli occupation forces, many restrictions were put on them, on their freedom to worship and so on. In Al-Aqsa in particular, and that is a very sensitive place for the Palestinians and obviously the the demolitions that, or another, there are obviously demolitions that take place in East Jerusalem constantly against Palestinian houses, but this time taking also the attempt to take Palestinian houses, as happened in the past, and give them to settlers who don't own them and who have no rights to be there in these houses in the first place.
And Yossi, yesterday also was Jerusalem Day. It marks the capture of the east of the city in 1967. This is usually a time of tension anyway, but it happened in the middle of Ramadan, and also just at the point where there is a legal case going on about this area of East Jerusalem that Atef just mentioned, which is trying to sort of put a hold on the Israelis taking another part of the city from the Palestinians?
Yes, of course. And I think we are looking at situation like today and mainly concentrate on the triggers, and the triggers are there. But the problem is the root causes of all of it. And I think we had many conversation in the past talking about how the situation could implode at any given time. Because as long as there is no fair and just solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict based on two-state solution, based on mutual recognition of self-determination, deal with the Palestinian refugees, ensuring that there is security for everyone, making sure that Jerusalem is the capital of both. The triggers will be there because of the tension. When people look at Jerusalem as a kind of a county, you visit Jerusalem as a place that is most of the time calm, it's a very thin veneer of calmness, because this tension that some of them Atef mentioned are there, and there are no solution. So it can be the Ramadan, it can be Jerusalem Day. It also plays into the hands of the most extreme. They thrive on this conflict, while what you need is exactly the opposite. The cool heads sit around the negotiation table and once and for all deal with all the outstanding issues.
Well, but tell us a little bit more, Asaf, what happens after clashes like this? I mean, is it a case of both sides saying, honour satisfied, they have a pause? Or are we looking at a situation where there has been such a build-up of anger that it's going to take a specific amount and kind of delicacy to soothe things here?
I think any soothing, if this word is to be used, will be very temporary and will not last. And I totally agree with Yossi when he said there's a thin veneer of calmness. The situation in the West Bank, in fact, in Gaza, in East Jerusalem, is just a powder keg that is always, waiting something to explode, because the underlying conditions are very, very extreme and very, very dire, particularly for the Palestinians. So I think, and the heavy-handedness of the Israeli army and the Israeli forces using force in a place of worship in such a manner that is so extreme, and so, around 500 people around Al-Aqsa and in Al-Aqsa have been injured so far. So unfortunately, I think the situation is just extreme because of just the nature of the conditions that are imposed against the Palestinians in particular. And this is unlikely to calm any time soon, particularly that it has this time also gone out of hand quite quickly, but also predictably. And even if they calm the situation, this will also be temporary, unless Israeli leaders, particularly the right-wing movements that are, thriving in Israel and in the Israeli government and in the Israeli institutions, unfortunately, particularly the judiciary, unless they unless this is turned around and they deal with the underlying conditions and they address the Palestinians fairly and justice for everybody, as just Yossi have just said, I don't think that there is calmness here. I think, and if this happens, it will just be on a temporary basis, unfortunately. Violence is inevitable.
Would you agree with that, Yossi, that violence is inevitable, any calm is temporary? I mean, yesterday there was talk that we were looking at a third intifada. I mean, it is a very dangerous thing to say. I mean, people were saying, please don't do that, because this will be overstating a situation or indeed inflaming a situation.
As in any other aspects of life, if you don't deal with the root causes, it's just a temporary measure. It's not more than a sort of a bandage to something which goes much, much deeper, and see what happens actually when you have situations such tense and and violent situation as we experienced, especially in the last few days, it go counter to the idea of peace negotiations. Because what happens in negotiation that require compromises, sometimes painful compromises for both sides, require trust. After rounds of violence like this, not that there is trust to begin with, it makes even worse. So it doesn't create, establish the conditions for negotiations. I think at this point, before it gets any worse, and it's bad enough, the international community should intervene quickly with a sense of urgency. The Security Council should have already been convened and passed a resolution. I think phones should be run between some of the capitals, both to Ramallah and Jerusalem, and tells the leadership that this is unacceptable also for the international community. But when the situation, it seems, comes down, not to leave it and not both sides to enormous machinations to force both sides to sit and negotiate.
Yossi Meckelberg and Atef Alsher, thank you both for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. Coming up to 7:12 here in London. Let's hear now about the latest population census issued by China. The results have come out in the last few hours, having been delayed several times. To go through the numbers is Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. Good morning, Isabel.
Good morning.
So what is the result? It looks like we don't have a decline, but we do have a slow in growth in China. Is that right?
Absolutely. In fact, we've got the biggest drop in growth that has been seen ever, really. And although it hasn't, they've just made the increase. But all the demographic experts say if it didn't decline this year, it will decline next year and it will continue to decline. So this is despite various official efforts to boost the birth rate, lifting the one child the punishments for having more than one child, but it doesn't look as though it's going to be enough. Well, couples, young couples say that one major disincentive is the enormous cost of raising a child now in China. That's gone up very steeply. And also, you know, you get this as a natural effect when you move a population from the countryside to the city. In the countryside, having children is a bonus, it's an asset, because you need the manual labour. In the city, though, it's a cost. And in Chinese cities, where the cost of housing and the cost of education and the cost of health are all pretty steep, you know, modern career couples just don't want more than one child. You've also got a lot of migrant labour. You know, those people who moved off the countryside, in general terms, the women moved into factories and the men became migrant workers on infrastructure and on building sites. If they had children, the children were left at home with grandparents deep in the countryside. And this could go on for years. So rural families, people who had a rural residency officially, those numbers also began to decline simply because couples weren't there. They were doing something else. But they couldn't get urban residency. They weren't entitled to live in the cities permanently, which meant that even those facilities that the state does supply to its citizens in the cities, so education and health, were not available to them. So they were there was a double disincentive there. There's another quite startling factor, I think, in this particular census, which is that the population and the birth rate, in Xinjiang, with a Uyghur population, has just fallen off a cliff. And that is very striking and will be quite embarrassing, I think, for a government that claims that the Uyghur population is happy, not oppressed, not in camps, a government which is working hard to refute the accusations of effective genocide amongst the Uyghurs. And that is going to take some explaining, I think.
So, we can also hear now from Sophia Yan, who's a Telegraph's correspondent in Beijing. Sophia, thank you very much for joining us. I mean, what's been the reaction in China at this not drop in population, but sharp slowdown in growth. The issues that Isabel has just mentioned, birth rate in Xinjiang, split between city and countryside, these are serious socioeconomic issues, aren't they?
Yeah, we've definitely seen a shift. Isabel mentioned the migrant workers in China. We've definitely seen a shift of people moving from more rural to urban areas. It remains to be seen how long that really lasts. But of course, this issue of the population eventually in decline, I mean, these latest statistics show that China absolutely is going to be dealing with a demographic crisis. And this is the world's second largest economy that we're talking about. Any change to the population, to the makeup of the people here, particularly to the working age population, obviously will have broad implications in terms of economic growth. Already we're seeing that section of the population, the working age part of the population, those aged 15 to 29, that group is starting to fall in size. It's about 63.4% of the population. That's according to data that officials released today. And that's down quite a bit from 10 years ago when the census was last done nationwide. And so it's this concern that policymakers really have to grapple with. Now, some experts think that the numbers have been a little bit fudged because it's so sensitive, this data. There was talk a few weeks ago because of a Financial Times report saying that the census data, which at that point had already been delayed for several weeks, was possibly going to show a surprise decline. And then the National Bureau of Statistics put out a statement saying that that wasn't true, that in fact the population did grow but didn't give any estimates. Again, still the data was not put out. It was still on hold. Finally, we have it today. But there's all of this just shows how sensitive this particular issue is and how policymakers are really trying to figure out how to present it to the country, to investors, to the rest of the world, because it has such widespread impact on what could happen here to the economy.
Isabel, what are your thoughts on this? Are we believing the official figures, or are we leaning more towards the data that was published by the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago? I mean, were it to be the case that there was a decline in population, this would just not be an embarrassment for China. They've already tried to reverse this, haven't they?
Yes. I mean, in a sense, it makes little difference if it actually declines this year or declines next year, because the trend is pretty much set. And as you say, the government has tried to encourage people to have more children. But I think that it's going to have to get much more assertive in that policy. I mean, really all it's done is lift the penalties for having more than one children, a deeply unpopular policy and unnecessary policy that was in place for many years. But it may have done it too late. And it hasn't really done anything to lift the disincentive, which is, as I said, one of cost and one of career impact. And those are much more profound social measures that would take quite a while to reverse unless they become coercive. And instead of punishing people for having more children, punishing people for not having more children. Now, the Chinese state has a tendency to coercion, but I don't think that policy would be any more popular than the previous policy. What's worrying them, of course, as we've heard, is the likely economic impact. You have a rapidly aging population. You have a very, very early retirement age. And China's hints that it would wish to lift that retiring age haven't gone down very well, because workers expect to retire when they think they're going to retire. And it takes quite a lot to lift that without getting a lot of discontent. But if you don't, then your ratio of retired people to working population becomes very difficult to handle. And the negative example, of course, for China is Japan, where when Japan reached this ratio, the economy slowed dramatically and essentially stagnated. But it stagnated at a much higher level than the Chinese economy is now. So the old nightmare that has haunted Chinese planners, which is will China get old before it gets rich, seems to be coming true.
Sophia, Isabel makes a very good point that this isn't just a Chinese problem, is it? She mentioned the issues in Japan. South Korea has seen birth rates fall to record lows in the last couple of years.
Yes, this is an issue that developing nations, particularly in Asia, all face. This is a huge challenge, as Isabel said, the issue of whether or not the country will grow old before it's able to grow rich. And it's a huge challenge for China. I mean, family planning policies have been around for decades and decades and decades. And a lot of the discussion around the lifting of those restrictions of the one-child policy to now have two, a lot of experts have said that that's really definitely too little too late. Even two kids isn't all that much, and it's expensive.
We seem to have lost Sophia then, so we will wrap it up. My thanks to Sophia Yan and Isabel Hilton there. Still to come on today's programme, Joe Biden joins the Bucharest Nine Nations for a meeting on keeping NATO's borders safe. So stay with us.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
The US President Joe Biden has joined a virtual summit of Eastern European NATO states who asked for a bigger presence of Allied military forces on the bloc's eastern borders. The aim of the meeting was to coordinate their security positions ahead of a full NATO summit next week. Next month, I should say. Well, Kit Gillett is a journalist based in Romania and joins me now. Very good morning to you, Kit. Welcome back to Monocle 24.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Good to have you with us. Right, just tell us what the purpose of, I mentioned briefly there, it's the coordination of security positions. But what actually was the a little bit more detail, please, if you would, on the purpose of the meeting?
Of course. So this was a virtual summit that included what's been referred to as the Bucharest Nine. Now, these are nine countries on the eastern flank of the European Union and NATO. So this is the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, as well as Romania, Poland, Bulgaria, Czech and Slovakia, and Hungary. And so these countries are the countries that, you know, are the ones that are closest to Russia, are feeling perhaps a lot of increased levels of uncertainty due to tensions between Russia and the EU and the US. Now, this summit, all of these countries are NATO members, and as you mentioned, there is this big NATO event next month. So this was really a moment to kind of get together along with US President Joe Biden to kind of put these countries' agenda on the map. And one of the big things that came out of this was, you know, a statement basically saying that these countries wanted a bigger allied military presence in, you know, on the bloc's eastern flank, which, you know, obviously, if that were to happen, that would ratchet up tensions with Russia, which, you know, are already quite high over Ukraine and other things.
We've had no public comment from Joe Biden, but what is it that he is thought to have said or thought to have agreed to when it comes to this kind of request?
I'm not sure if there is anything that has been agreed. I think this meeting was more of a discussion and a laying out of what these countries are hoping for and their position. I think what we will see next month at the NATO meeting is perhaps more concrete things decided, steps decided. One of the interesting things that was said during, you know, at the opening of this summit by Romanian President Klaus Iohannis was, beyond, you know, expressing kind of thanks for Biden being part and the US administration and, you know, their renewed support for NATO, it was actually the mention of Article 5, you know, front and center, which is the article that got President Trump in trouble years ago when he declined to mention it, which is the, you know, the firm support of all nations. If one is attacked, all, you know, all step up.
Tell us a little bit more about what the US can actually do in this situation. I mean, earlier this month, it said it could increase security help for Kiev, for Ukraine, after the Russians moved troops very, very close to its border with the Donbass region. There is not much more that the US can do other than say, you know, turn up at the meetings and say, yes, we are with you.
Yeah, I mean, the support right now is more visual than actual, in a sense. You know, last week we had the Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Kiev, and that was a, you know, a meeting that had both symbolic and, you know, was more symbolic than anything. He went there and, you know, showed his support for Ukraine and reiterated the country's support for what's happening in Ukraine. So that was a symbolic move. And a lot will be perhaps symbolic. There is a way of ratcheting up. All of these countries have NATO bases within them. Romania has Aegeus missile shield base in the country, which is part of the defence of Europe. So there is military presence, and those could be increased. Whether that happens, we will have to wait and see. But yeah, a lot of the support perhaps will be more symbolic than actual, I imagine, going in the near future at least.
And that is something that was echoed by the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg yesterday. No public call for a bigger presence in Eastern Europe, but also nonetheless saying that, I think he said something about the US commitment to rebuilding alliances and strengthening NATO is something that's very, very important. What does NATO do when it comes to try to bring countries together who ordinarily may not stand side by side in agreement on lots of issues, but have to find themselves working under the NATO umbrella?
I think, in many senses, the ratcheting up of tension with Russia has become perhaps more of a unifying issue. So, if there is no outside threat, no outside concerns, then yes, it is harder to get everyone on the same page. But there is this growing tension we've had. And actually, in the statement that was released after the summit yesterday, there was explicit mentioning of the explosion in the ammunition dump depot in the Czech Republic, the expulsion of... Or the kind of investigation of kind of Russian activities of some diplomats in Bulgaria. So I think, when these countries have growing concerns, that unifies them. I think that's what we're seeing right now.
What do you think might be then said, looking forward to next month when the Bucharest 9 join a full NATO summit next month? I mean, will they be seen as the Bucharest 9, or will this all be have to fit more neatly into a bigger NATO view?
Obviously, these countries are not large when it comes to NATO. They do not have an oversized influence, and I think this summit yesterday was part of a way of kind of growing their influence a bit by showing a united front and saying, we are 9 countries. We are the 9 countries basically closest to, the eastern flank of the EU, of Europe. We're the, closest to Russia. We're watching just across our borders into Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, and seeing kind of the increased political tensions there. We should have our voice heard in this. And I think they would hope that, this summit yesterday and their kind of united front will help that voice. I think it will be hard to have a strong say, but I think there is a lot of attention right now on this region, on what is happening, especially with regards to Russia and its kind of presence, its influence, its soft power plays in this region, that I think there will be attention paid.
Kit Gillett, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come, the latest in our look at the major barriers to achieve a fully vaccinated world. Hesitancy from communities who don't want the jab. But first, with the time just coming up to 7:29 here in London, a quick summary now of some of the world news headlines. 3 journalists and 2 activists who fled from Myanmar to Thailand have been put on trial for illegally entering the country. If convicted, they're likely to be sent back to Myanmar, where they say they'll fear they'll be killed. Dozens of journalists have been arrested since the military staged a coup 3 months ago. The US network NBC has said it will not show the Golden Globes because of a lack of diversity. NBC, which has aired the award ceremony since 1996, said it wants to see meaningful reform. WarnerMedia, Netflix and Amazon Studios have already refused to participate in events related to the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, whose members vote on the awards presented at the Golden Globes. They haven't had a single black member for 20 years. And the US has authorised the Pfizer vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds. The Food Food and Drug Administration said it was a significant step in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. The vaccine's already being administered in teenagers aged 16 and upwards. And those are the headlines on The Globalist. Now, all this week on The Globalist, we dig deeper into one of the major barriers to achieving a fully vaccinated population. Hesitancy from communities who just don't want the jab. Born out of reasons as diverse as government mistrust, religious beliefs and conspiracy theories, in this series we take a look at why scepticism has evolved and how it is being combated. Well, in today's episode, we're joined by Eboo Patel, who's president of Interfaith Youth Corps, a Chicago-based non-profit that aims to promote interfaith cooperation to look at the intersection of health and religion. Eboo explains how his organisation is employing a faith-based approach to combat vaccine hesitancy and just how crucial this is to reaching herd immunity in the United States.
For us here, pastors, they have huge followings. And whatever they say is taken as gospel truth.
I happen to have been a parishioner here at the service, the last service that Tim presented before he was diagnosed with COVID-19. That experience made us become very aware. And
as a pastor here, there are people sending you things, please, please look at this, please pray for me, I'm really worried about this, I'm scared, because people can't work out whether it's true or not.
Health and religion have always been mixed, right? I mean, there's a great African-American spiritual about there being a balm in Gilead, for example. The Quran is described as a healing. Yoga was not invented by athletic wear companies. It was invented by Hindu sages. So we shouldn't be surprised that health and religion are mixed. And we also shouldn't be surprised that there's a major question about trust. And the question is, when it comes to people's health and their understandings of their body, who do they trust to guide them along those lines? And it turns out that, at least in the United States, there's an awful lot of trust in certain segments of the population of religious leaders. This is the case for white evangelicals. It's the case for African-American and Latino Protestants. It's the case for a whole range of Muslims and Hindus and Catholics. And so I think that there's a powerful partnership to be made between religious leaders and public health and government authorities. Actually, a great example of this outside of the United States is the small country of Bhutan. The government and public health authorities worked with Buddhist monks there to identify, quote unquote, auspicious period to begin the vaccination campaign. And once that was identified and it was kind of blessed as such by the Buddhist monks, the Bhutan vaccinated 93% of its population in a period of 2 weeks. So according to this major study that we just put out, it turns out that 26% of all vaccine-hesitant Americans would be encouraged by some kind of a faith-based approach towards vaccine uptake. Turns out that amongst white evangelicals who go to church, almost half of them would be encouraged by some kind of a faith-based message or engagement, and about a third of African-American and Latino Protestants. So these are quite high numbers who say that basically they would trust a clergy member encouraging them to get a vaccine, or if there was an information session held in their congregation, or if they heard that somebody within their church had gotten a vaccine and it had gone well. And so basically IFYC is using this research to inform our action campaign. We're calling it the Faith in the Vaccine Ambassadors campaign, and it trains college students and faculty members at largely religiously affiliated colleges to work within their congregations, to hold information sessions, to make phone calls, to start conversations about the importance of the vaccine, not just for medical and health reasons, but also for spiritual and religious purposes. So a great example of this is the idea that the body is a temple for the Holy Spirit, right? And so you treat your body as the place that is sacred. And there's a lot of particularly African-American clergy who are talking about the vaccine as something that facilitates that.
Welcome to today's edition of Clergy and Clinicians. Our show today is really exciting. It's about helping folks in the Greater Bronzeville neighborhood and beyond understand health issues that affect them. And they're going to be answered by many of the leading experts from Northwestern Medicine.
You know, there's a remarkable data point in our research around this. And that data point is that of African Americans who go to church, 57% say that they are encouraged to take the vaccine. And that compares to 43% of African Americans who don't go to church. And what that basically says is that African American clergy are encouraging their congregants to take the vaccine, and those congregants are listening. Incidentally, the numbers are basically reversed when it comes to white evangelicals. White evangelicals who go to church say that they are less likely to take the vaccine than white evangelicals who don't go to church. And what that indicates is that there's a lot of white evangelical leaders who are either ambivalent and who are not saying much, and some of the loudest voices are actually discouraging the vaccine.
Well, I think there are a lot of pastors who are. They're doing vaccination drives in their congregations. They're helping people to understand what can be gained.
All of which is to say that we do, in fact, see what you might call a quote-unquote clergy effect. But it's not just collared religious leaders. It's anybody within the community. And so there's all these inspiring stories about young Muslim women who are calling the aunties and uncles in the masjid and telling them that, you know, they're going to medical school or they're in public health programs and that the vaccine is safe and that it's halal and that, in fact, it's part of the Islamic idea of serving the common good and that there's a vaccine clinic in the masjid and they should come. A huge part of this is the respectful way people engage in conversations with people who have questions. And an awful lot of that has to do with their identity, right? Some of this is doctrinal. You know, is the vaccine halal? Did the vaccine use stem cells? That's doctrinal. But some of this is just, will I trust the person who I see in the masjid for Juma prayers every Friday? I know that person's a doctor and she is always looked out for me. And that's the person I want to talk to about this. What our research is showing is that vaccine hesitant people are excited to have conversations with people that they trust, which is often within their own ethnic and racial and faith community, about the vaccine. The path to herd immunity runs through people's religious convictions. And actually, that is not just the next leg of the vaccine rollout. That was very much the initial leg also. Amongst the most vaccine questioning communities in the United States, for very good reason, are African Americans. And that's because, you know, literally dangerous experimental studies have been done upon them in the past that have had ill health effects. And so there's very real reason for them to say, are you experimenting on my body again? And it was Black clergy who did their own research and conversations with public health authorities and scientists about the vaccine, became comfortable with it themselves, and have led their congregants to the vaccine in a variety of extremely inspiring ways. And so we have seen this work with an enormously important religious and racial community in the United States, and our research shows that it could work with other important communities. I am hopeful. We're in the ground game phase of this now in the United States, and so, you know, it's not going to be like tens of thousands of people getting max vaccinations anymore in geographical areas. It's going to be hundreds here and thousands there and maybe a few dozen here and there. And that's going to happen through information sessions at faith communities, and it's going to happen in intimate conversations between congregants. And inshallah, God willing, it does happen.
That was the president of Chicago's Interfaith Youth Corps, Ibu Patel, for the second part of this week's series on vaccine hesitancy. Tune in tomorrow. We'll have a special report from Hong Kong examining what factors there are driving vaccine hesitancy in the city-state. Stay with us on Monocle 24. We'll be looking at the newspapers next. And joining me to go through the papers is Terry Stiasny, political journalist, author and regular voice here on Monocle 24. Good morning, Terry. Good to have you with us.
Morning.
Right, so it is Queen's Speech Day here in the United Kingdom. So lots and lots of things to examine and explore. We all know about what's going to happen even before she's opened her mouth, because that is the way that the British press work. So tell us, this is a Queen's Speech Day logistically, which understandably has to be very different.
Yes, that's right. Normally the Queen's speech is very heavy on the ceremony and all the heralds in their gilt clothes and the Queen in her crown and so forth. And this Queen's speech, the last one we had was in December 2019, and obviously so much has changed since then. This is going to be a socially distanced Queen's speech. There will be very few people listening to it. According to The Guardian this morning, they say there will be only 74 members of the House of Lords. And traditionally, this is a time when all the members of the House of Lords cluster in as tight as they can, all in their, you know, ermine and velvet robes. They will have to have COVID tests in advance. They will have to wear masks this time. And normally another part of the tradition is that Black Rod, one of the officials, summons MPs from the House of Commons to come to the House of Lords to, you know, commands them to attend the Queen, who traditionally has the door slammed in his face. And then all the MPs from the House of Commons sort of cluster in as well to listen. Only a couple of them will be allowed to go this year. So only the Speaker, the leaders of the party and the whips will go to listen to the Queen. So the traditions are going to change a lot this year. So it will be very different. And the Queen returns. I think in the Times, will be wearing a hat and not a crown. So, but the substance is also very interesting.
So no ermine-clad clustering. I'm absolutely devastated by that.
So I think this may still be ermine. It will be socially distanced ermine. So.
Fair enough. One does what one can with one's ermine. Let's look at the substance of what the Queen is going to be talking about. Obviously, she doesn't write the speech. It's written for her by the government. And this is the government doing its Build Back Better job, isn't it? The focus that the headlines are examining a lot today is on adult education, the idea that we'll be able to get loans to retrain.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is a phrase which certainly, you know, sounds like it comes from Downing Street rather than the Queen. The government, according to the Times, will pledge to put rocket fuel under its levelling up agenda, which is an interesting sort of mix of metaphors there. But the substance of that is that there will be more access to training for people who don't have the equivalent of A-level. So that's, you know, the qualifications you get in the UK when you leave a school at 18. And that there will be effectively student loans for those who want to do training throughout their life. And part of that is, you know, this is to try to appeal to the people who we saw in the local elections before the weekend still voting for the Conservatives, particularly many of their new seats in the north of England. They're going to call this a lifetime skills guarantee and to try and get people into better jobs. And one of the other things is housing. So The Guardian points out that housing and easing planning rules to make it easier to build more houses and allow greater home ownership is one of the other big sort of issues of substance in this.
Tell us a little bit more about the substance of all this. There are many accusations being thrown at the Conservative government, which is they are very, very good at making announcements. For obvious reasons, many things have had to be put on hold for more than a year. But just how much faith is there that this will actually happen?
I think, well, the difficulty certainly with housing and planning is that there's always a tension between what your new voters might want and what some Conservative MPs might want. So people who represent, say, the more traditional Conservative seats in the south of England may not want huge new housing developments built in their constituencies, although some of the people wanting to buy houses may do that. So that is often a difficult thing to get through. And one of the other interesting things it's worth pointing out, so the Financial Times mentioned this here. They say that the Queen's speech is paving the way for a re-election bid by Boris Johnson. So they point out that there's going to be changes to voting, which will require voters to provide proof of identity, which has become very controversial. They're also planning to lift the fixed-term Parliament bill, which means that Parliaments currently have to sit for a certain length of time, which might allow the Prime Minister to call an early election if he thinks things are still going well for him. But one of the other things that people point out is missing from this, which many governments have wrestled with in the UK and still not managed to sort out, is the issue of social care. So there still seems to be some argument going on about how you fund and how you improve the situation in terms of social care and how we pay for it.
Finally, looking at not the Conservatives, but the opposition, Labour, they had a battering over the weekend in the various elections that the United Kingdom went to. The Labour leader and deputy leader Angela Rayner has written a public letter saying that there could have been a leadership challenge given the way that Keir Starmer actually handled things.
Well, yes, I think it's more so the Times is reporting that there could have been that when he tried to demote his deputy, Angela Rayner, that things could have got so bad in terms of the contradictory briefings that she could have threatened a leadership challenge because the Labour's deputy has their own mandate. They are elected by themselves. Angela Rayner herself, who has a new and very long, complicated title, including being in charge of the future of work, has written an article in The Guardian, which she made some really quite pointed comments that you could see directly directed at Keir Starmer. So she is saying, for instance, that for too long, the people we're here to represent have felt we are distant from them and from their lives, pointing out how she went from having no qualifications in a minimum wage job to where she is today through the help of the trade union movement, and how important it is for Labour to reconnect with people she calls, you know, the mates that I grew up with and who are working in minimum wage jobs, that we need to speak to and speak for again. And for too long, we've given an air of talking down to people and telling people what they need and what they should want. So there's shots fired there between the Labour leader and the deputy.
Only to continue, one suspects. Journalist Terry Stiesny, thank you so much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's talk transport news, and Monocle's transport correspondent Gabriel Lee joins me now. Good morning, Gabriel.
Good morning.
Let us begin with the bounce back with the US aviation sector. Staff are being hired, planes are taking off, cabins are being filled.
Right. It's quite a different picture from this time last year or a little bit earlier when everything was shutting down. People were getting furloughed, all that. With sort of a surprisingly quick turnaround, we're seeing not only all the furloughed and temporarily laid off workers being brought back, but also now airlines like Southwest in the U.S. are saying they're going to start hiring new people and, you know, sort of looking at those conditional letters of employment from last year again. So it's very sort of positive over there, at least.
It's positive. And is there a sense that actually this is a positivity which is enduring, that the aviation industry can enjoy a certain amount of confidence again?
In the specific markets where we're seeing bounce backs, for example, in large domestic markets like the U.S., where vaccinations are looking quite good and people have this sort of renewed confidence about travel, I think it is something that should be, unless things go crazy again, it should be something that's enduring. But in other places, of course, we still really don't know what's going to happen. For example, in Europe, it's a very different picture here.
Yes, tell us a little bit more about what's happening in Europe, because there is still such a large amount of doubt and uncertainty about what is going to happen in the next 2 months. And of course, we are heading into the time when everybody tries to get away for some kind of holiday if they can, if they're able to. And yet the pause button is still very much in control here.
Yes, Europe's aviation sector is well below that of the rest of the world in terms of, you know, represented as a percentage of what it was last year. So while we see, you know, pretty good bounce backs in North America, Asia, especially places like China, in Europe we're still down something like 74% from the same time in 2019 before all of this happened. So it's a combination of the fact that, you know, you have small countries with many travel restrictions between them and a slower vaccine rollout. So a lot of indecision politically, a lot of lack of confidence on the part of the flying public, I guess. So yeah, it's at the moment, it's looking the worst in the world in terms of the sort of bounce back among airlines.
And what effect is that having on the sort of the imbalance in the aviation sector? If suddenly Europe looks as in an awful amount of trouble, if something doesn't get sorted out quite quickly and a normal service doesn't resume, whereas in America, as you've just described, there's only a comparatively small drop in the number of passengers.
It's certainly bad news for the flag carriers and even the low-cost carriers of Europe. They're the ones who'll be suffering here, especially those like the ones based in the UK, where there's still very tight restrictions about entry and a lack of a clear path forward as to which countries will be allowed in or which countries people will be allowed to fly to. So definitely we'll be seeing very different fortunes among airlines, for example, compared to the US versus those European carriers. And they'll be hoping that changes soon.
And similar situations in terms of other parts of the world as well. Taiwan is quarantining all China Airlines pilots after an outbreak linked to a hotel that they were staying. Now, China Airlines has a very good track record and the organisation and the location has been good at controlling the virus. This is an indication that it is still very, very susceptible, isn't it?
Right. Things can go wrong all of a sudden, even in places where, you know, life has more or less returned to normal, at least within the country, especially in these places, perhaps, where they've contained the virus to a large extent. So one outbreak in a hotel is a big deal, as opposed to, you know, in Sweden or the US, it's not as big news, right? But this is a sign that, you know, this is going to affect China Airlines in a big way, and it will affect the movement of cargo, especially in and out of Taiwan, in a big way. Shipments will be majorly disrupted, potentially, because these pilots are all going to now have to quarantine to break the chain of transmission, basically. So it's a sign of how things can go very quickly wrong again, too.
And do we have any indication that it will have wider implications for confidence in the region when people have felt as if they have been able to get on planes and cargo has been able to move? Just one case can have quite a serious knock-on effect, can't it?
Right. And especially in these places that have been largely closed. I mean, Taiwan remains very difficult to enter, and I don't think a lot of people are leaving there right now. So these places that have done a very good job of basically closing the gates and stopping the virus, they're going to have the hardest time moving forward, trying to open up again, trying to add flights or to let their people fly out or people to come in. That's going to be probably a very long process. We saw Australia commenting that it may not be until the end of 2022. That they start really letting travel happen again. So it's a long road potentially, especially for these places.
Gabriel Lee, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. This week's episode of Monocle on Culture is a special one. It's 500. And Robert Bound heads to a special place, to the world-famous recording studios in Abbey Road here in London, to learn about their legacy and the groundbreaking initiatives in technological development and creating opportunities for a more diverse workforce. Well, here Robert is taken on a tour by Mirek Stiles, a long-time employee of Abbey Road Studios, currently head of audio products.
My name is Mirek Stiles. I am the head of audio products here at Abbey Road Studios. So I work with companies and we create software recreations and hardware recreations of some of our old classic gear. Before that, my previous incarnation here at Abbey Road Studios was as a recording engineer.
I'd love to know, before we start the tour, how you felt when you first turned up to work here, actually, on your first day. You've been here for a while. You still get a thrill walking across the pedestrian crossing and walking up these steps. But what was day one like for you?
Very exciting. Bit of a blur. I couldn't actually believe I was here. I remember I was sort of touching the walls to see what sort of material was on the wall. I was fascinated by all this, the acoustics and the gear and the desks, and it was kind of mind-blowing, first of all.
Oh, wow. And through a little, small, unglamorous doorway, where do we find ourselves, Mirek?
We're in Studio One, the cavernous-sounding Studio One, as you can probably hear in my voice. So this is where it all began. This is the centrepiece of Abbey Road Studios.
Because this has got kind of, if you don't mind me saying so, the storied Studio One here at Abbey Road. It's got a kind of school gymnasium vibe about it somewhat, but that's the colour scheme as much as anything. What are these blue, this sort of top panel above sort of maybe 10 foot high? It looks like blue plasticky stuff, but I bet it's not.
It's actually just blue panels found in a hardware store in the mid-70s by Ken Townsend, the manager.
You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, yeah. So the studio hasn't changed since the mid-70s, and now it's considered one of the finest sounding rooms in the world. We wouldn't touch it for love nor money. We've got to be very careful with it, actually. But like I say, they're always trying different things to try and liven up the sound. They even tried a system where they had a series of speakers around the walls, and they would feed some of the recording back into the room at very low volumes, so you don't get feedback, to sort of try and liven the room up a bit, which didn't work very well. Apparently it sounded awful. So they were trying all sorts of things. But anyway, at the end of the day, they found this blue panelling in a hardware store, I think, yeah, by Ken Townsend, and they thought, let's just try this. And it worked. I mean, it's a beautiful sounding room. They got the reverberation time up to sort of 2.3 seconds, I think, now, and it's a lively room. I mean, when you've got an orchestra in here and a choir in here, I mean, the room sings. It's like, it sounds beautiful. Obviously, a lot of classical music recorded in here. You know, Sir Edward Elgar, we've mentioned, Pablo Casals, Yehudi Menuhin did like over 200 recordings in here. Some of the big band stuff, like Glenn Miller did some stuff in here. Fats Waller on his organ. There used to be a big organ in here, a big Compton organ. Classical music dried up in the mid-70s, I would say, from a point of view that most of the repertoire had been recorded for vinyl, if you like, or cassette. And there wasn't a huge amount of new repertoire coming through. That changed in the very early 80s when CD came along. It's like, okay, we've got this digital thing going on now. Let's just re-record everything nice and clean, release it on CD. But in the mid-70s, that hadn't happened. So there's this lull. And it was a massive problem, particularly by the late 70s, because the suits at EMI were like, why is this room empty? It's a huge room in a very expensive part of London, not doing anything. So they thought of quite drastic measures. One of them was to divide this room up into two smaller pop studios with underground car parking.
Wow. Yeah.
Not be standing here.
Imagine that's like being the executive that didn't sign the Beatles, right? Doing that to Abbey Road.
Yeah, that could be, yeah. I mean, you could see what they were thinking. You know, in around about the time, pop studios all over London, it was like a big business. People couldn't record at home like you can now. If you wanted to record something, you had to go to a studio. That's the way it was. So it kind of made sense. But luckily, Ken Townsend, he was thinking like, you know, this is a historic room. There has to be another way. And I guess fate kicked in there a little bit, because there was a film scoring stage called Anvil Films over in Denham. And that's where they recorded like Superman, the first Star Wars, Alien, that sort of thing. It was like a renowned film scoring stage. The lease was up on their building. It was being knocked down and redeveloped and turned into a shopping center or something horrendous, you know. And so they were looking around for a new home for Anvil Films. And it just so happened that this room wasn't being used much. It was a fantastic alternative to turning it into two pop studios. So they struck a deal. So in the 1980, Anvil Abbey Road Screen Sound was created. And that was Abbey Road's first dip into the world of film music. So one of the very first scores to be done here was Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981. Return of the Jedi was done here in 1983. And it just kind of snowballed from there, really. RoboCop, Highlander.
You're just talking about your favourite films now, aren't you?
Literally, Aliens. You know, they're all done here. It's crazy to think that these classic films and these classic scores by these amazing composers and amazing directors, it was all done in this room. So, and to this day, film music is, you know, the centre of this room is, you know, film music and Avengers Endgame and Gravity and Shape of Water and Black Panther. You know, they just keep coming. You know, Lord of the Rings, you know, it's just Harry Potter's, you know, you name it, it's been done here.
Thank you. And my thanks to Robert Bound for that brilliant tour of Abbey Studios. Tune in to the latest edition of Monocle on Culture to hear the full report. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers Marcus Hippie, Carlotta Rabello, Paige Reynolds and Alexis Self, our researcher Charlie Phil McCourt and our studio manager Louis Allen, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, more music on the way, the briefing's live at midday in London and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.